big nose. She looked like a figurehead in a ship. She had been a schoolteacher, but had taken early retirement. She was delighted to see her niece, and plied her with tea and cakes. Harriet refused the cakes. "I'm on a diet." She leaned forward and said, "You always said looks didn't matter."
"That was a bit stupid," said Agnes. "I think men don't matter. Careers last, men don't."
Harriet sat silent, staring at the floor. Agnes looked at that unfortunate little moustache.
"Are you a virgin, Harriet?"
"No.
Why do you ask?" demanded Harriet. "Are virgins hairy?"
"Yes, well, some of the time. Tell you what, there's this Bosnian woman, Sonia, who has set up a wee place 2 doors away. She can clean up your face and eyebrows. Lassie, you've got lovely eyes. Did no one ever tell you that?"
"A policeman did."
"Come on, this is exciting."
Had Sonia been a hard-faced, sophisticated blonde, or something similar, Harriet would have backed out of the shop. But she turned out to be a grey-haired woman in her 70s, with a motherly face. Harriet emerged some time later, blinking in the sunlight. Her aunt was almost skipping along the pavement.
"You look a different person altogether. Now, clothes."
"I've plenty of clothes, Auntie. What you've got on is baggy and shapeless. Let's go."
There was no pretty woman or Cinderella moment for Harriet when she arrived at work. She was just Harriet to the staff, but something different. When they did notice was when the new European sales rep, Monsieur Pierre Duval, came into the offices. He was 40-ish, with thick, curly black hair, a tall, rangy body, a smile and, oh, that French accent. And the boss was busy and asked Harriet Munro to take this pagan god for lunch.
"What's happened to Hairy Harriet?" hissed a filing clerk. "Why does she get to take him to lunch?"
But Harriet had one great seductive talent. She was a good listener. After she had given Pierre a succinct description of the firm's business in Scotland, she asked him about himself. He talked about the firms he had worked for, said he was originally from the Auvergne region of France, but had mostly worked in Paris. His wife had left him for another man, and he had no children.
"But you wear a wedding ring," said Harriet.
"I am only telling you about the divorce. If I tell the ladies, they can get the wrong idea."
"And I am not a lady," said Harriet.
"Oh, you are my confessor. I haven't talked this much in a long time. I look into those beautiful eyes of yours, and I open my big mouth and yakety-yak."
"You'll get a warm welcome in Scotland," said Harriet. "We have strong historical ties with France."
"Then why do people hate us so much?"
"What are you talking about?"
"This is really the country of John Knox, is it not? I have been called a papist, as if it is something dirty."
"Oh, dear," said Harriet. "Pay no heed. There are so many bigots around. It's said people will kill for love, but look at all the fanatics who kill over religion. I have a certain sympathy with that professor who was murdered. Get rid of religion and God. But he was too passionate. Gosh, there must have been a lot who could..."
"What is it?"
Harriet shook her head.
"An idea. I'll need to think about it."
Spring moved into summer, and Hamish had almost forgotten the murders. They hung around somewhere at the back of his mind, but crime was nearly non-existent. The days were warm and sunny, and he spent long hours fishing with his 2 dogs playing in the heather. And then one Sunday, when he was returning to the station, he saw a small woman he did not at first recognize. It was only when he drew nearer and saw those eyes that he realized it was a transformed Harriet Munro.
"Miss Munro, what brings you? Nothing up, I hope." "May we go? I've been turning this theory over in my mind. Probably daft."
"Come, Ben," urged Hamish, marveling at her new appearance. In the kitchen, he pulled out a seat for her at the table.
"Coffee?"
"Yes, please. Black, no sugar."
Hamish sat down opposite her. He noticed a diamond ring on her engagement finger.
"Who's the happy man?" he asked. a French sales rep, but he's got a job in Lyon, and we're moving there. I want to be away from my father. I don't want to be crushed again, although it'll never quite go away. Somewhere deep inside me, I'll always be Hairy Harriet.
Have you heard from Martha?
Not recently. She used to be on the phone the whole time. Selwyn had got her pregnant. She got an abortion and a new job. She's personal assistant to the assistant manager of Homeland Gin.
And is that what you came to tell me?
No. I came to talk about religion.
You would think with IS and all that that there would be fear and hatred of the Muslim community, but it is the hatred between the Protestants and Catholics that runs deep.
So I remembered what you said, all of it, about the minister preaching the Song of Solomon in the kirk when Olivia was there, about the minister's sister having a crush on Selwyn. So I got to thinking, what if Sheila was desperately in love with Selwyn? And what if the manipulative Olivia thought it would be fun to get the professor and Peter Haggis together and see what happened? Sheila sees her brother losing not only his heart, but his faith. Selwyn couldn't keep it in his trousers, so he led Sheila to believe that if Olivia were out of the way, he would marry her. I think she might have killed him. I think before that, she followed the professor when he left the manse one evening. I don't think the whales in the tower scared her one bit. Maybe she coaxed him up there, claiming to be frightened. Such a man as Professor Gordon would pooh-pooh all supernatural manifestations. Maybe she pushed him. Maybe he just fell into the hole under the leaves and broke his own neck. Maybe I'm talking rubbish. I mean, it's nothing to do with Catholics versus Protestants. It's just that religion in Scotland can rouse black and dangerous feelings. It could be the minister feeling that Professor Gordon was trying to destroy his faith. Or perhaps Sheila, worried about her brother, passionate about Selwyn and hating Olivia.
"You've given me a lot to think about," said Hamish.
"Maybe I've got it all wrong and it's nothing to do with a woman after all. I'm anti my own sex at the moment."
"Why?"
"When I was Hairy Harriet, the women in the office were so friendly, always wanting help with computer stuff and so on. Ever since I got engaged, they skulk in corners and glare at me."
"You'll soon be shot of them, so don't worry."
"That's not really what is bothering me."
"So what is worrying you?"
"Do I really love Pierre, or is it because everyone else seems to think he's such a glamorous catch?"
"I'm sure you do," said Hamish.
He wanted to say that if you were in love, you had no doubts about it. But then he had met happily married couples who knew love but not the highs of romantic passion.
When she had gone, he realized it was Sunday. He phoned up Jock at the store in Drim and found there to be an evening service. Before he set out, he drove to Brakey to see how Alice Douglas was getting on. Handy's sister had agreed to continue paying rent on the villa. He was relieved to find Alice Douglas at home, and looking happy and well. Hamish had been afraid he might find her husband back again, or that he had been replaced by another brute. Such had been his previous experience of battered wives. He refused tea, only pleased to see that for Alice the nightmare was over. Her divorce would be final in late summer. When he left, he found there was still time for him to visit Dick and Anka, but he had to admit to himself he was jealous of Dick. "I'm no better than Harriet's office women," he thought. But he went on up into the moors and let the dogs out to play in the heather. Maybe he was chasing after idiotic solutions, he thought. He lay in the bell heather with his hands behind his head and watched two buzzards sailing up against a pale blue sky. There had been enough drugs in Handy's possession to drive men to kill. The gang pretending to be builders could easily have done the murders on Handy's orders. The genuine company in Invergordon had said that Handy had employed them, but failed to say, until later, that he had paid them off some weeks before Hamish had first met Handy. Perhaps the professor, Olivia, and Selwyn had somehow just got in the way. At last, he rose and whistled to Lugs and Sally, and headed off through the calm evening to Drim. He was late, and as he parked the Land Rover, he could hear the strains of the opening hymn, "Abide with Me," floating out on the evening air. He slipped into a pew at the back of the church. Peter Haggis looked remarkably tame and ordinary, far from the impassioned man who had read from the Song of Solomon. He seemed to be going through the motions of conducting the service. He intoned a sermon on God's forgiveness, saying the piece about there being more rejoicing in heaven over the arrival of a sinner than of one righteous man. Hamish studied the backs of the heads in front of him. He recognised some of the Crofters and their wives, and Jock and Ailsa, and Edie Aubrey. Drim had always been a secretive place. Someone had once put forward the view that people who lived at the end of valleys were more withdrawn and superstitious than people who lived in the open plains. Had all those crossed branches at their doors been meant to ward off a real and present danger rather than a ghostly one? He shook his head. No, that couldn't be right. Threaten a Highlander? Jock and his neighbours would have descended on those supposed builders with their shotguns at the ready. Why couldn't he just relax? As Handy had proved to be that most hated thing in Hamish's mind, a corrupt police officer, then it stood to reason that a few murders wouldn't bother him. He possibly didn't even have to do them himself, just order one of the gang to do it for him. But he sensed badness in the church, caused by fear. After the service, Hamish decided to go to the builders in Invergordon the next day. If he even got a scent of villainy from them, he could leave suspecting anyone in Drim alone. They had been investigated already, but he wanted to see the firm for himself. Charlie said he would come with him. They decided to find a cafe somewhere for lunch, because both were feeling guilty at relying on the hotel's picnic hampers. "It's all Polish food now," said Hamish. "My mother remembers when it was the Italians. Not that they served spaghetti in the cafes. Pie and peas, fish and chips, burgers and snacks. But they were so clean compared with the old fly-blown dumps." "I like the Polish places," said Charlie dreamily. "Polish lassies hae these cheekbones. I like a lassie with high cheekbones. I like the food as well." Invergordon, on the east coast, is a town known for repairing oil rigs on the Cromarty Firth. It is sometimes known as Little Glasgow because that's where so many of the workers came from. The builder's yard was situated on the waterfront. As they drove up outside, Hamish noticed that it looked like a regular family firm. At first he got a sour welcome from a man, Strachan Mackenzie, who said he was part owner.
"I've had enough of you lot. Had to complain to the chief constable."
"That would not have been because of a detective chief inspector Blair?" asked Hamish.
"Aye, that's the bullying bastard. Get the hell out of here."
Hamish smiled.
"Now, I am not bullying you, am I?"
"No,
but I am not accusing you of anything at all. I only wondered when your men had stopped working for Handy Ebrington over at Drim, see? A simple little question. You answer it and we'll go away."
"Oh, well," he said in a mollified tone, "I ken it fine. He pulled the crew off last December. One of my men went over and saw a squad working and I phoned him about it. He said he'd got a cheaper builder, so that was that."
"Now see how easy that was," said Hamish. "We're off."
"I wonder why Blair thought it necessary to go for him," said Charlie, as they got back into the Land Rover.
"It was probably a few minutes before opening time," said Hamish, "and the idiot craved a drink. There's a place here, I mind, called the Purple Turtle. Good burgers."
They each had a large lunch, so large that Hamish could feel all his worries about the murders slowly fading away. Harriet Munro was a very forceful personality. Perhaps he should take this opportunity of going back to the lazy life in Loch Doo he loved so much. By the time he dropped Charlie off and cruised slowly down into Loch Doo and saw the village lying by the calm loch, he decided that life was too short. Why fight it? But why had Blair not investigated further, once he found out that the real workers had been laid off? As he climbed down from the Land Rover and let the dogs out, he turned and saw Heather Loman standing by the kitchen door.
"What is it now?" asked Hamish wearily.
She threw back her head and placed a hand on her bosom.
"I have a boyfriend!"
"Many happy returns," said Hamish. "Stand aside."
"So I just want you to know, I don't need you."
"That's grand, Heather. Good night."
Hamish strode past her, let himself in and slammed the door. He wondered whether Mrs. Wellington realized that her niece was a fantasist. Did she really have a boyfriend? Or had some hiker stopped to ask for directions and smiled at her? He filled the dogs' water bowls. Reminding them sharply that he had fed them hamburgers, he strolled into the living room and sank down on the battered sofa.
Women, he'd never understand them.
But Harriet Monroe certainly would. She had not thought that the idea of the murderer might be a woman too far-fetched. Could it have been Handy's sister, after all? Could she really not have known where the money came from? Or what about Sheila Haggis, with the haunted, passionate eyes? He contemplated visiting Sheila the next day, and trying to get some suspicious reaction out of her. But he had been looking forward to a day's fishing on the river with the Colonel and Charlie. Before he fell asleep, he suddenly remembered Martha Dundas. She had been made pregnant. She'd had an abortion. But he could picture her breaking down and sobbing, not having the passion-fueled rage necessary to kill a man. What had the autopsy on Selwyn found? He had been struck on the head with a blunt instrument. Hamish tossed and turned for most of the night. By morning, he had decided that he must investigate only a little further to get any peace of mind. He phoned Charlie and said he would not be fishing. He checked his bank balance. Not bad. He had won first prize for hill racing at the last Highland Games. Forget Drim for the day. He would fly down to Glasgow and see if he could find out anything from Frieda. Hamish was always amazed that a city like Glasgow, which could produce some of the warmest, kindest, funniest people on the planet, should yet give birth to someone like Blair. He arrived in the late afternoon and took a taxi to Frieda's home. Frieda turned out to live in a mews house at the back of one of the Victorian terraces in the West End. Although it was small, Hamish reckoned it would cost a lot, around 400,000. He suddenly wished he had phoned in advance. Maybe she had found a job. He rang the bell. A seagull suddenly screamed overhead, staring down at him, as if demanding to know what he was doing so far from Loch Doo. The door suddenly opened, and Frieda stood there, wrapped in an old-fashioned camel-hair dressing gown.
"I'm right sorry to wake you," began Hamish. "You didn't. I was having a siesta. Come in."
The front door led straight into a living room, which, Hamish guessed, would have been the carriage house when it was built. He could never understand the fashion for mews houses. They had been built for coachmen out of cheap brick, and were usually north-facing. The living room was cold and dark, shadowed as it was by a large wall outside the window on the other side of the narrow lane. Hamish looked around. There were no expensive items. The furniture seemed to be of the cheapest kind. There were no books or pictures, just a large television screen on one wall. The three-piece suite was upholstered in brown corduroy. The coffee table in front of it was of the flat-pack kind.
"So sit down and tell me what brings you," said Frieda. "I am just curious," said Hamish. "You see, I cannot believe your brother murdered anyone. But he may have ordered one of his gang to do the killing."
She shook her head.
"Now look, is this official?" "No, and I don't want the police to know I've been here." "Well, in return for signing a lot of papers swearing me to secrecy, I had to agree that my brother was a serial killer, so they could secretly close the case while giving him an honourable burial. I agreed, in return for this place, a payoff and goodbye. But Handy phoned me before he fled to the airport. He told me he had never killed anyone, although he had been dealing drugs. I felt sick. I swear to God, I thought the money came from the sale of Lady Jane." "Did you know he was very religious?"
"Handy?"
exclaimed Hamish.
I can't believe it. Oh, believe it. You see, to him, drugs were just another form of alcohol. He swore cannabis was safer than booze any day.
So you did know about it?
He talked to me on the phone all the way to the airport. It was the first I'd heard of it. I think it all began when his last marriage fell through. She was a nasty little gold digger, and she dumped him for some rich villain over on Clyde Bank. I think he went a bit off his trolley after that.
He may have taken again that professor for his anti-God preaching, said Hamish.
I don't think so. If Professor Gordon had called, I'd have seen him, I'm sure of that. Look, are you sure no one must know you're here?
I would lose my job.
Then why don't I take you out for dinner? Forget about the damn case. Or maybe I'll get drunk and remember something useful.
Well, maybe somewhere not too expensive, said Hamish.
Oh, I can afford it. Wait till I change.
What about me? Protested Hamish, who was in civilian clothes.
I don't have a tie. You've got a white shirt and tweed jacket on. I've got a tie somewhere. The last one-night stand left it. Help yourself to a drink. In the kitchen.
Hamish wandered into the kitchen. He opened the cupboards. He found one cupboard full of medicine bottles and packets. He noticed packets of amphetamines. His eyes narrowed. The only way she could have got that amount was illegally. He poured himself a small whiskey from a bottle in another cupboard, and then sat down in the living room to wait. Frida eventually appeared, wearing a leopard-skin patterned blouse, tight jeans and stilettos. She handed Hamish a tie.
"Before we go out," said Hamish, "you've got a supply of drugs in the kitchen. Did your brother get them for you?"
"No."
"You sure you're not here officially?"
"I swear." "I got them through Maggie's."
"Could you do me a favour?" pleaded Hamish. "Don't take any afore we go out. I canna bear folk on uppers. They chatter, 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 and think they're being so witty when they're boring for Britain."
"Bitch, that's what you are.
Oh, let's go."
She swung a white mohair stole around her shoulders. They dined at Seafood Lux, a fish restaurant in the centre of Glasgow. Hamish would have enjoyed a plate of lobster Newburgh immensely, if it had not transpired that Frida must have had some uppers cached somewhere else and had taken them before leaving the Mews. She gabbled on and on about what a bastard her late husband had been and how he used to beat her up.
"I wonder if he ever punched her in the mouth," wondered Hamish,
watching the thin red lips opposite pour out venom. He fantasized having a roll of duct tape, tearing off a strip and shutting her up so that he could enjoy his food. There is nothing more infuriatingly sad, he thought, than the type of woman who wears leopard print clothes, takes uppers, and decides she is utterly fascinating. She had ordered a bottle of Nuit Saint-Georges, cackling,
"So it's red, so what?"
She glugged most of it. Actually, glugged, thought Hamish. He could hear it going down her gullet. Glug, glug, glug. A large man suddenly loomed over their table.
"Evening, Frida," he said. "Who's your fella?"
"This is Donald Gordon," said Hamish quickly.
"And how did you two meet?" the big man asked.
"Don't I get an introduction?" asked Hamish.
"My name is Barry Wilkinson, for my sins."
Hamish had a sudden malicious desire to annoy.
"What have your sins got to do with it?"
"Oh, just a way of speaking.
Where did you two meet?"
Hamish rose to his considerable height.
"Push off," he said. "You're spoiling my evening."
Barry turned bright red, but muttered,
"I'll be waiting for you."
When he had left, Frida said,
"Oh, Lord, that was one of my ex's best friends."
But the visit from Barry had calmed her down. Frida suddenly said she did not want dessert or coffee. She wanted to go home. Hamish told the waiter to call a taxi. He escorted Frida to the door of the restaurant, but did not go outside with her, only bidding her a firm farewell. Then he walked back in and asked if he could use a back or side entrance, tipping the waiter heavily. The waiter led him through the kitchens and out into a lane at the back. Hamish cautiously circled round and looked at the front of the restaurant. Barry was standing there with two evil-looking thugs. Hamish retreated back down the lane, which joined another one, and so allowed him to make his way out and round to Buchanan Street bus station, where he caught a bus to the airport. He slept in the airport on a hard chair, and woke up wondering if any of his journey had been of any use at all. Hamish was often to think that if it hadn't been for the midges, those Scottish mosquitoes, the murderer might have got away. He woke the next morning, and, as he fried bacon for breakfast, he experienced a feeling of relief. Once more it was a sunny day. Why should he worry and fret? He collected his fishing rod and tackle, and set out with his dogs for the Tommel Castle Hotel. Charlie was delighted to see him, but the Colonel was not, and was apt to sulk. It was when they were out on the river that black clouds of midges descended on them, and not one of them had remembered to bring any repellent. They packed up and fled back to the castle, and the comfort of antihistamine cream. Hamish then drove back to the station. The day had turned muggy, a milky colour, and the loch was still and flat. A seal cut a V through the placid water. It rolled on its side, and appeared to stare straight at Hamish. He gave a superstitious shudder. The Highlander believes that people come back as seals. Hamish had a sudden impulse to talk to the policeman, Carl Strith, the one who had claimed to have heard Handy confessing to the murder of Selwyn. He decided to ask Angela to keep an eye on his dogs, and then wondered why he had not thought of talking to her again, instead of going all the way to Tain to take Harriet out for dinner. He realised uneasily that even with her hairy appearance, there had been something almost magnetic about Harriet, and a strong, earthy sexuality. "My mind's in my balls," he said to Lugs, as he walked along the waterfront in the direction of Angela's cottage.
"Did you hear that?"
A shrill voice right behind him made him jump. He swung round. There stood the Curry sisters, eyes accusing.
"I am not going to explain," yelled Hamish. "Run along! Shoo!"
"Letcher!"
howled Nessie, and her echo said,
"Letcher!"
but in a plaintive wail.
"Is everyone mad?" wondered Hamish, as he dived thankfully in the open door of Angela's cottage. "If I don't disappear somewhere for the day, they'll all be round at the police station, the monstrous regiment of women, staring and accusing and claiming I've broken Heather's heart or something."
Angela said she would take care of the dogs, unless they dared to bark at her cats, in which case she would lock them in the station. Hamish had called at the hotel to borrow Charlie's car, not wanting the police Land Rover to be noticed in Strathbane. He parked several streets away from the station, and phoned Jimmy, saying he wanted to talk to him in private. To his surprise, Jimmy told him he would see him at Joe's Cafe in the High Street, instead of choosing a pub. Hamish was even more surprised to find a healthy-looking Jimmy marching into the cafe.
"You look great," he said. "Off the booze?"
"Aye, for a bit, until my liver gets a rest. There's this new nurse at headquarters, Shona Sutherland. Man, blonde hair and legs up to her armpits. I'll get a date out of her yet.
So what do you want?"
"I want a quiet word with Carl Strith."
"He's gone, left the force."
"So where is he now?"
"I don't know," said Jimmy, looking exasperated. "Look, thanks to you, I am Strathbane's golden child. Don't rock the boat. It's all swept under the carpet. Forget it."
"Okay. Why did this Carl leave the force?"
"I don't know,"
said Jimmy, moodily, stirring the froth on his cappuccino.
"Yes, you do."
Jimmy jumped to his feet.
"Sod you! I'm out of here."
Hamish gazed after him. Someone must know where Carl had gone. But Strith was an odd name. He paid for the coffee and walked back to the car, where he looked through the local phone directory on his iPad. No K. Strith, but a J. Strith was listed on Rannoch Crescent off the Loch Inver Road. Hamish drove to the address and knocked at the door of a trim bungalow. A woman with hair dyed so blonde it was nearly white answered the door.
"Does Carl live here?"
asked Hamish.
"I'm his mother. Why do you want him?"
Just a wee chat for old time's sake. I was on the force with him. You'll find him at the mall in the centre of town. He's one of the security guards.
Hamish drove off again. A greasy drizzle was smearing the windscreen. Normally an unambitious, contented man, Hamish felt upset and uneasy. It was all very well for Jimmy and his like to sweep everything under the carpet, but he could not rest easy thinking there was a murderer on the loose. He parked in the mall's multi-story, and then walked through the mall, looking to left and right for the security guard. Outside a computer shop, he saw a tall, thin young man in a security guard's uniform. Hamish approached him.
"Carl Strith?" "Yeah, that's me. Who are you?"
Hamish was not in uniform. Hamish introduced himself. Carl had pale grey eyes. They suddenly looked like sea-washed glass.
"What do you want?" he demanded. "A wee talk about Handy's confession."
Carl stared at him for a long moment and then asked,
"Who sent ye?" "Relax. No one knows I'm here. Let's go to that coffee shop over there."
Carl shuffled his feet. He was still wearing his old regulation boots. Then he glanced at his watch.
"Okay, it's nearly my break."
In the coffee shop, Carl ordered hot chocolate with marshmallows on top, and Hamish had a black coffee.
"Who's paying?" demanded Carl.
"I am."
Carl promptly put 3 iced doughnuts on a plate and took them with his coffee to a table, leaving Hamish to pay the bill.
"So," said Hamish, "what gave you the idea that Handy confessed to murdering Selwyn Sinclair?"
"Because I heard them."
"You've got icing sugar all down your tunic," said Hamish.
"Now, here's what is happening. I think I know who the real murderer is, and I'm going to expose that person, which will show you up as a liar. What do you think of that?"
Carl had fair eyelashes, which blinked rapidly.
"But he did say it. Detective Chief Inspector Blair heard it."
"Oh, aye. But I swear you didn't."
"Look, this is what happened. Blair tells me that Handy whispered the confession, right?"
"Okay."
"He says to me, he says, 'I'll let you take the credit, laddie.' Well, Blair's the big cheese, so I fair jumped at the chance."
"So why did you leave the force?"
"Well, see, Blair takes me aside and says it's all got to be hush-hush, and they'd find I'd been lying. He said he could get me this job, and man, I jumped at it. Better pay and regular hours."
"Carl, you've cleared my mind," said Hamish. "We won't talk any more about it."
Chapter 11. When the Himalayan peasant meets the he-bear in his pride, he shouts to scare the monster, who will often turn aside. But the she-bear, thus accosted, rends the peasant tooth and nail, for the female of the species is more deadly than the male. Rudyard Kipling. Hamish drove slowly and thoughtfully to Drim. He wanted to visit the manse and sniff the air, put out the tentacles of his Highland radar, and see if he could pick up anything. If he sensed everything was all right, he might drive to Tain and find Martha. Selwyn had got her pregnant. She was the one who had found his body. Why not just get the police to check up on him? "Because she was pregnant," said a voice in his brain, and probably desperate. As he drove down into Drim, a little round black cloud blotted out the sun, sending a shadow lying across the manse. "If I ever get this cleared up," he thought, "I never, ever want to come here again. I hate this place." He rang the bell. Silence. A puff of wind sent angry little waves coursing down the loch. A seagull screamed and dived, and then silence fell again. Hamish retreated to Jock's shop. Ailsa was behind the counter.
"Seen the minister?" asked Hamish. "Haven't he seen himself the day?" said Ailsa. "Want a pie? Got some fresh."
"No. Wait, are those Anka's baps there?"
"Aye, get a big delivery every week from Breaky. They're all right, even though they've been frozen."
Hamish realised he was hungry.
"What about a bacon bap, Ailsa?" "Sure, coming up." "Want a beer?" "I'm driving." "You can't arrest yourself, and one won't put you over the limit." "Fine, Ailsa, that would be grand.
Did you know about anyone peddling drugs around here?
No, not even a bit of pot.
What about uppers?
No such luck. I'm that tired these days I could dare with something.
When Hamish's food was ready, he took it outside to a small table, along with a bottle of beer. He looked across the curve of the Loch's Bay towards the manse. Perhaps there would be an evening service. Surely Haggis must return to prepare for that. He was just finishing his bap and the last dregs of beer, when he felt there was something out of place, something that had caught the corner of his eye. It had been over in the direction of the manse and the round church. There it was. There was a flicker of light across a narrow window of the church, and then it had gone again. He got up and got rid of his trash before striding off in the direction of the church. When he got to the main door, he tried the handle, but the door was locked. He was about to knock, when he had a sudden desire to see what was going on inside in secret. He walked round the side of the church, through the Celtic crosses on the graveyard, to a side door. It was locked as well, but it was a simple Yale lock. He took out a thin strip of metal he kept for cases such as this, and sprang the lock. He found himself in what he gathered was the vestry. Hamish gently opened the door into the main body of the church. He stiffened as he heard a familiar voice.
"You see, I am a good judge of character," the voice was saying, "and Macbeth will never give up, so you pair are going to take the rap. You, Sheila, have that typed confession in front of you. Sign it, and you and your brother will have a quick, nearly painless death. Don't sign, and it'll be hell on earth."
Hamish edged forward. Harriet Munro was standing with her back to him, holding a wicked-looking black revolver.
"As God is my witness, we will never, either of us, sign such lies. Do your worst, and may God have mercy on your soul," said Peter Haggis.
Hamish was glad that brother and sister had tape over their eyes, otherwise they might have seen him and alerted Harriet. He eased up to the altar and seized a plain brass cross.
"Let's see how long you can last," jeered Harriet. "We'll start with your kneecap, Sheila."
"Why are you doing this?" wailed Sheila.
"I told you. Sign that, or bango your kneecaps."
"No."
"Very well."
Hamish threw the brass cross. It caught Harriet on the back of the neck, and she dropped like a stone.
"I hope I haven't killed her," thought Hamish. "I couldn't stand the paperwork."
He went up and felt for a pulse. She was unconscious, but the pulse was quite strong. He tore the tape from Peter and Sheila's eyes and mouths. Both had wet themselves with fear, and Sheila was as white as clay. Hamish phoned for an ambulance, and then spoke to headquarters. He eased the revolver from Harriet's hand. It was a Model 1892 revolver, standard issue to officers in the First World War. He wondered if it belonged to her fiancé, perhaps a family souvenir. A roll of duct tape that Harriet had used to bind her prisoners lay beside Sheila's chair. Hamish picked it up and used it to secure Harriet's wrists and ankles.
"Go into the manse, Mr. Haggis," he said. "You'll feel better when you clean yourselves up."
Sheila tried to stand up, but her knees buckled under her.
"On second thoughts," said Hamish, "leave her be for the moment. Do you have anything to make tea with in the kirk?"
"There's a wee kitchen next to the vestry."
"Right. A cup of tea with a lot of sugar."
Peter's eyes burned with passion.
"I prayed to the Lord to save us, and he heard my prayer. I will never doubt again."
"Great," said Hamish sourly. "Make the tea."
If he pointed out that it was a very human Hamish Macbeth who had saved them, then he was sure all Peter would do was call him an instrument of God. Hamish soaked a handkerchief in the font, and knelt down beside Harriet and bathed her forehead. Peter came back with a cup of tea, but Sheila moaned that she wanted to go home, and this time was able to stand. Harriet's eyes suddenly flew open. For a brief moment they looked puzzled, and then slowly filled with hate. She rolled over on her side.
"Tell me all about it, Harriet," coaxed Hamish.
He drew out a powerful little tape recorder and placed it on the floor.
"It's just you and me, Harriet."
"Why?"
"I loved him," she said.
He said he'd marry me if he could get rid of Olivia, so I did it for him. And then droopy Martha corners me in the ladies and starts to cry, saying she's pregnant and he won't marry her. So Selwyn was such a bastard. I knew I'd never live a quiet moment while he was on this earth. I called at his home late, said something important in business had come up. They had one of those glass rolling pins in the kitchen, and so when his back was turned getting me a drink, I biffed him hard.
And what about the professor?
She sighed. I used to meet Selwyn in the tower. We didn't for a minute believe in ghosts, and it was one way of making sure no one would disturb us. I went to meet him, and there's this prof poking about. He said he had come to talk to the minister, but had decided to inspect the ruin instead. He wouldn't go away. I was exasperated. I gave him an almighty push, and imagine my amazement when he staggered back and fell through the floor. When Selwyn arrived, I persuaded him a hotel room would be a better bet, and off we went. But I was frightened the body would begin to smell. I forced myself to go down there one night. I found his car keys. He had left his car up at the entrance to the village. I drove it up on a bluff, and then sent it down into the loch. Then I got that old wheelbarrow from outside Jock's. I knew about that passage. I smashed the locks and put other padlocks in their place. I wheeled the body down to the loch and pushed it in. It gets deep quick, and the tide was going out, and it took him away.
With a feeling of relief, Hamish heard approaching sirens.
"Why me?" he asked. "Why go out for dinner with me and encourage me to go on hunting?" "Because I knew you would never give up, that you would get round to me in the end. I saw it in here."
She tapped her forehead and stared at him with those wide, wide eyes, and for a moment he experienced a shudder of fear.
"But what a waste," said Hamish. "Everything was coming right for you. Too late. Imagine what it was like. But there were a couple of times when Martha couldn't go on trips with him and he took me. He made me feel beautiful."
The sirens wailed like so many banshees heralding death. Hamish's phone call had exploded at headquarters, and a full contingent, headed by Daviot, arrived. Hamish formally told Harriet she was being arrested for the murders of Olivia and Selwyn Sinclair. When Daviot walked in and demanded a report, Hamish stood to attention, and delivered it, and remarked he had also got it on tape.
"Why couldn't you have left well alone?" shouted Daviot,
and then turned red with embarrassment as Hamish stared at him.
"I mean, well done, Macbeth."
Blair lumbered forward, looking worried.
"Are you sure, Macbeth, that this wee lassie did those murders?"
"Miss Munro has confessed. When I arrived, as I have just reported, she was threatening to shoot Sheila Haggis in the kneecaps if she did not confess to the murder."
Daviot summoned two policewomen to take the prisoner to Strathbane. Jimmy Anderson and Detective Andy McNab said they would follow, and begin the interrogation. The forensic team moved in, and Hamish, Daviot, Blair, and a detective constable called Henry Fox moved to the manse.
"I've phoned the doctor," said the minister. "We are both in shock."
"I see Miss Haggis has already taken something," said Hamish, looking at Sheila's washed-out, dreamy face.
"We have some Valium. I admit she may have taken too many."
Daviot introduced everyone and explained he would send a car for them in the morning so that they could make their official statements at police headquarters.
"But in the meantime," said Daviot, avoiding looking at Hamish, "Detective Fox here will take your preliminary statements. Macbeth, there is no need for you to stay."
"Don't be ridiculous," said Peter, waspishly. "That sergeant saved our lives. He is part of our statement."
"Yes, yes," said Daviot fussily. "You may stay, Macbeth."
"I think I can take the statements here," said Fox. "I have my computer and a travelling printer with me."
"Oh, good man," exclaimed Daviot.
Hamish intercepted the wary, calculating look Blair threw at Fox. Good. As long as the detective chief inspector had someone else to worry about, it suited Hamish very well. At last it was over.
Sheila and Peter Haggis signed their statements and were told that someone from victim support would be arriving.
"That was efficient, Fox," said Deviot. "I follow your example at all times, sir," said Fox.
"Oh, dear," thought Hamish. "Now Blair is really worried. Fox is not only clever, but a sycophant as well." For that was why Deviot kept Blair close. He was a weak man, unsure of his position and with a domineering wife. He relied on Blair to boost his ego. But Fox was young and clever, with a pleasant face and a lilting Irish accent. He knew Deviot would immediately lean on him because there would be mountains of paperwork. At least Handy hadn't been a murderer, unless you considered supplying drugs as mass murder. Perhaps people who planted the seeds of death should take the rap as well. What about Harriet's jeering father, and Handy polluting the Highlands with dangerous drugs? It could be argued that Selwyn and Olivia, with all their seductions and manipulations, brought about their own murders.
"So she murdered the Professor as well," he realized Peter was saying.
"No, I think she was telling the truth when she said he fell through the floor and broke his neck. He had been seen with Olivia Sinclair."
"I fear that may have been my fault," moaned Peter. "I told Olivia about the hauntings at the tower, and she said she would introduce me to the Professor, who didn't believe in God and would knock some sense into me. I loved Olivia, and she laughed at my faith. May God forgive her. But thanks to God's messenger, Sergeant Macbeth, I do believe."
He fell to his knees and began to pray, while the forces of law and order stood around him and shuffled their feet, with the exception of Fox, who was studying Hamish. He had heard whispers that it was really Hamish who solved crimes and let other people take the credit, because he didn't want promotion. He would get close to Hamish and study his methods. And then he realized Hamish was looking at him and giving an infinitesimal shake of his head. He looked down quickly. He felt uneasily that Hamish had just read his mind. Blair wished someone would stop the praying minister so they could all leave. He was worried sick. Strith would need to keep his mouth shut and not tell anyone it was he, Blair, who had claimed to have heard Handy confessing to the murder of Selwyn. All the Biggins, the Suits, would be back with their endless questions and demands for quotes in triplicate. The young smugglers would walk free of any charge. Why had he done it? He would not admit that he was jealous of Handy, and it was because Handy had treated him with contempt. He began to fret. He could not possibly leave until forensics had finished with the church, and then he and the others would be expected to examine it. Waste of time, he fretted. Macbeth had it all sewn up, the bastard. And that crawling wee creep Fox was a danger. He had even joined the lodge. Like Jimmy, he had temporarily stopped drinking alcohol, and now he craved a dram with terrible ferocity. And then he felt a gentle tug at his sleeve. It was Henry Fox, his guileless blue eyes looking into Blair's tortured ones. "Would you be liking a wee dram, sir?" he whispered. "I have a flask." For one brief moment, Blair's face lit up. But then it closed down and he snapped,
"No drinking on duty."
Fox stepped back and nearly collided with the tall figure of Hamish Macbeth, who said, out of the side of his mouth,
"That's no the way to get his job, you manipulating sod."
But the devil was on Fox's side, because Peter had long finished praying and had left the room, only to return with a bottle of fine malt whisky and a tray of glasses.
"I was keeping this for Hogmanay," he said, "but this is a special occasion. The good Lord chose to send his angel of mercy to rescue me and Sheila." "No drinking on duty," snapped Deviot.
"But I insist," said Peter. "One glass won't put anyone over the limit."
"Oh, very well," conceded Deviot.
Hamish groaned inwardly. He always got the better of Blair because Blair was stupid. But this Fox was a new danger. The trouble was that Deviot needed someone to crawl to him and praise him on a daily basis, and Blair filled that role. He also saw Jimmy reaching eagerly for a glass.
Hamish remembered a former Benedictine monk he had met when the man was on a walking tour. He had found him downing whiskies with the locals at the bar on the waterfront, and entertaining everyone with tales of the monastery. Hamish now remembered him saying, with a gentle smile, "The Holy Roman Church is right down on sex, but they are simply marvellous when it comes to booze. We all used to look forward to a visit from the bishop. How the wine would flow!" It seemed now as if this rather strict Scottish church saw nothing wrong with the stuff either. He found Daviot approaching him. "Where is Carter?" he demanded. As my suspicions could have turned out to be nothing more than a flight of fancy, I had to leave him to handle things back in Loch Doo. "The Colonel is right pleased with him," Hamish went on, with that vague look in his hazel eyes which meant he was lying, "because Carter evicted two bad troublemakers from the bar. And, sir, when the Colonel praised him, Charlie said it was because of your training, sir." Daviot beamed. "Splendid! Splendid!" "And I am as bad a creep as the rest of them," thought Hamish, as Daviot walked away. They finally got the news that the crime scene was free for examination. Blair said that Hamish should go and type up his report at police headquarters, and that he and his detectives could do the rest. Glad to escape, Hamish drove to Strathbane. He had two thermoses he always carried with him, and had them filled up at one of the new coffee shops in Strathbane. He found a spare computer in the detective's room, and began to type, but was always aware that somewhere below his feet in the cells was Harriet Munro. He had liked her. If he hadn't been so busy playing Pygmalion, his wits might have been sharper, and he might have recognised the danger. On and on he typed, half his mind wondering how Blair would cope with the new threat of Fox. Fox managed to see that Blair was supplied with more whiskey. He did not realise that, although Blair was relatively stupid when it came to detection, he was as sharp as a tack concerning his own self-preservation. And so Fox did not notice that most of Blair's whiskey was ending up in the font, unnoticed until the following Sunday, when the about-to-be-christened baby was saved at the last minute from having a face splashed with water and alcohol. And Blair knew exactly why Fox was plying him with drink, and a deep, red hatred blossomed inside his fat, hairy bosom. In the scramble to get to the crime scene, Blair had taken his own car, a small Peugeot. He knew that the airbag on his side worked, but not on the passenger side, a fact he had discovered when he had run into a fire hydrant, his wife beside him. His wife only survived because it was a 20-mile-an-hour zone.
"How did you get here?" Blair asked Fox.
"With Jimmy Anderson."
"Why don't we leave them to it, laddie?" said Blair, with a fat smile. "She didn't kill anyone here in the Kirk, just tied them up."
Fox agreed. Daviot had left, so there was no point in hanging around to impress anyone. Blair drove steadily along the heathery one-track roads. He was very tired, and his eyes were gritty with lack of sleep. A red sun was staring right in his eyes, and he mumbled and pulled the sun visor down. He glanced sideways. Young Fox was asleep. As he finally crested the top of the hill that led down into Strathbane, he could see one of the rare trees of Sutherland halfway along. He put his foot down, and the little car surged forward. He hit the tree at 60 miles per hour. His airbag exploded against his body, but Fox, without one, was thrown violently against the windscreen, shattered the glass, and lay half in, half out of the car. When Blair struggled out, he found himself horrified at what he had done. Fox's face was bluish-white, the bits of it that could be seen through a mask of red blood. Dizzy and frightened, Blair stumbled along to the nearest croft house, which was well off the road and up on the moors. He rang the bell, and fell unconscious on the doorstep. Fox was not dead. He slowly recovered consciousness. Rain was beginning to fall, cool rain washing the blood from his face. He dragged himself back into the car, letting out yelps of pain, sure he had broken his ribs. He eased into the driver's seat, behind the deflated airbag, and started the engine.
Only later did he realize how lucky he had been that the car had not burst into flames. He reversed the car, which gave a howling, grinding noise as the front bumper, caught on a low tree branch, was torn off. Half stunned and barely aware of what he was doing, he drove at 30 miles an hour to Strathbane Hospital. An ambulance, a fire engine, and a police car arrived at the Croft to find a recovered Blair being administered to by the Crofter's wife. The paramedic said he should allow himself to be taken to hospital for checks. In his initial statement, Blair said he had been driven off the road by a gang of bikers. "Poor Henry Fox," mourned Blair. Other police returned and said there was no sign of the car. Blair turned white and nearly fainted. Hamish had just finished his report when he heard the news of Fox's accident. He decided to visit the hospital and see him after he had delivered all the copies of his report. He bought a bunch of grapes from the hospital shop and, following directions, found young Fox in a private room. Fox was conscious. When he saw Hamish, he said, "Where is Detective Chief Inspector Blair?" "Somewhere in this hospital, I think," said Hamish. "What happened?" "I don't know. I was asleep." "I heard you didn't have an airbag." "Bad luck, that," said Fox. "I wonder if Blair knew that." "Possibly," said Hamish. "Do you mean he tried to murder me?" "I'm sure he didn't," lied Hamish. "But hear this. Blair is arch toady around here. Two of you competing to see who could be the biggest would make you look a fool and damage any hope of promotion. And end up like you, stuck up in the back of beyond." "But alive," said Hamish. "Watch your back." As Hamish drove back to Loch Doo, he felt a shiver go down his spine as he thought of Blair. The whiskey must finally have begun to get to the detective's brain. He had just shown himself capable of murder, and it wasn't only young Fox who should look out. Epilogue. "See the happy moron. He doesn't give a damn. I wish I were a moron. My God, I think I am." Anonymous. A week later, Hamish got a visit from Jimmy Anderson. To Hamish's relief, Jimmy showed no signs of wanting alcohol, settling happily for a cup of strong coffee. Hamish put out deck chairs in the front garden, because it was a fine sunny day with only the faintest of breezes rustling through the rambling roses that hung over the blue police lamp. "Have some shortbread," said Hamish. "It's from the minister's wife as a peace offering. She tried to tie me up with her niece, and has only just found out that said niece is as daft as a brush when it comes to men, and thinks she's Cleopatra." "Thanks, I will," said Jimmy, reaching down and taking a piece of shortbread from a plate on the grass between the chairs. "Did I tell you I've been invited to Dick and Anka's wedding?" "No, you didn't." "I still wonder why she chose Dick." "It's like this," said Jimmy. "It's like, say, a top violinist with a Strad meets another with a Strad, and they're both the best. Don't get it? Baps are like music. They should write an anthem to the Scottish Bap. Dick always was obsessed with cakes, and along comes the cake and Bap maker supreme." "So sex doesn't come into it?" asked Hamish, scratching his fiery head. "Cakes are sexy. I bet there are American cops who would kill for a decent cream doughnut." "Oh, well, I'll never understand. How's Harriet bearing up?" "Quiet. Reads a lot." "Put a suicide watch on her." "Why?" "Right down in there, afore she got twisted, is a warm-hearted, clever woman. She won't be able to live with herself for much longer. I know she's basically good." "Hamish, you kind of go around bumping off people and be basically good." "I don't know." Hamish scratched Lug's ears and gave Sally a bit of shortbread. "I think we're all capable of murder if someone treats us so badly that our brains get damaged. And talking of damaged brains, what about Blair and Fox?" "Oh, Blair was probably drunk or sleepy. The bikers, he claims, forced him off the road are nowhere to be found."
He knew the airbag on the passenger side didn't work, because his wife told me, said Hamish. I'm telling you, he tried to kill Fox.
Havers, Hamish, he's an old swine, but kill anyone? Nah.
But Hamish felt uneasily that Blair had finally crossed some sort of line. He privately resolved to have a quiet word with Fox. But the days were lazy and fine, and Hamish had almost forgotten his decision to warn Fox. That was until the man himself appeared one day at the police station, just as Hamish was finishing his breakfast.
"What brings you?" asked Hamish. "Coffee?"
"I am curious about you," said Fox. "I came to see why a bright copper like you would want to stay stuck up here. I took a look around, and I still can't figure it out." "Sit down. Have a coffee. Help yourself to milk and sugar. The trouble is, you are over-ambitious, and it makes you blind to everything else. You do realise that Blair made an attempt to kill you." Fox had just helped himself to a mug of coffee, and he had been about to add milk. He held the jug frozen in the air. Then he slowly poured a little milk and set the jug back down on the table.
"The bikers?" he said.
"I dinna believe for a moment that there were any bikers," said Hamish. "Blair knew the airbag on the passenger side didn't work because he and his wife were in an accident not so long ago. He fears you'll take his job because you're a better creep than he is."
Fox looked amused at the insult. "Is there any other way to get on in the force?"
Hamish sighed. "There was a time, or so the old retired coppers have told me, when they went into the job to help the community. Yes, they could be rough and tough, but there was a streak of altruism in them just the same. I think Blair has crossed some sort of line."
Fox laughed. "Unless I get to him first." Hamish felt a jolt of alarm. He hadn't really meant that. Or had he? He stood up.
"I have chores to do. Why not take a look around? Loch Dhu is beautiful."
"Okay. Thanks for the coffee."
Strolling along the waterfront, faced by some of the most beautiful scenery in the Highlands, all Fox saw was a dead-end sort of backwater. That was until he saw a vision strolling along the waterfront, sunlight shining in her blonde hair. He rushed up.
"May I help you?"
She looked amused.
"As you are obviously a stranger here, it is probably I who can help you."
He stuck out his hand.
"Detective Constable Henry Fox at your service, ma'am." "Priscilla Halberton-Smythe at yours. Now I must get on, I'm going to see Hamish."
She had her back to the police station as she was talking to him, and over her shoulder, Fox saw Hamish send one hunted look down the waterfront, and then disappear. He said goodbye and waited, leaning on the sun-warmed wall of the waterfront. She came back slowly.
"Not there?" he asked. "Never mind. What about a drink?" "Too early,"
said Priscilla, and walked quickly away to where her car was parked.
That was class, thought Fox. With high rank and pay, he could get himself one of those. And yet, what had such a gorgeous creature been doing, wasting her time on Hamish?
Hamish's sudden realization that he was to be best man at Dick's wedding hit him when he got an anguished call from Anka, summoning him to the wedding rehearsal. In all the subsequent fuss, in all the heady emotion of seeing Dick and Anka married, in all the subsequent pain of a momentous hangover, Hamish forgot all about Fox. As stocky little Dick walked down the aisle with the glorious auburn-haired vision that was Anka in white lace, Hamish, like every man in the church, wondered for the 100th time how it was that Dick, of all people, had snared such a bride. Then there was the reception at a large marquee just outside the village. The Polish relatives had arrived with a crate of 150-proof Polish vodka, and the Curry sisters and Mrs. Wellington fell over during an impromptu show of Tai Chi. But Fox had not forgotten Blair. He discovered, to his chagrin, that on Daviot's wedding anniversary, Blair was invited to the small and exclusive dinner party, along with the Procurator Fiscal and the Lord Lieutenant of Sutherland. Like all Celts, he was passionate and capable of fierce hatreds and resentments. He had been watching a number of real-life crime stories on television, mostly American ones, and was fascinated, as Hamish had been, at how many cases of poisoning had gone undetected. Blair smoked heavily. Fox had read about a case recently where a child had died after drinking the contents of a refill for an e-cigarette. "Put three of them in a bottle of liqueur, say," ran his thoughts, "and send it anonymously to Blair as a present." At first he dismissed his idea as pure fantasy, but then it would not go away. Until one day he drove as far as Wick and bought a bottle of Drambuie and three refill bottles. "The strongest for my e-cigarette," in a tiny Asian supermarket, where they did not appear to have CCTV. For every three people in the British Isles, there is one CCTV camera, so he felt triumphant at actually having tracked down a place without one. Back in Strathbane, he wrapped the bottle up in fancy paper, blessing the Asians who could cram so many things into one small shop. He found out Blair's address, and, on his day off, waited outside in a hired car. He saw Blair leave for work. Still, he waited. Then Blair's wife, Mary, came down the steps and got into a car and drove off. It was then Fox realized that there was probably some damn camera somewhere in the street. He drove off, went home, and found a cardboard box. He set out again for that store in Wick, where he bought bubble wrap and duct tape. In his excitement, he forgot to wear gloves. He packed up the bottle and addressed it to Blair. The shop was also a sub-post office, but he did not want to be remembered, and if he posted it there, it could be tracked. He retreated all the way back down to Strathbane, put on a disguise, and posted it from the main post office. Mary, Blair's wife, although an ex-prostitute, was an exemplary wife and adored by Mrs. Daviot, because clever Mary had quickly transformed herself into a woman who wore well-cut tweeds and spoke with a posh accent. But underneath, the old Mary was always there, tough, clever, and ruthless. Blair suited her very well, and her past career had taught her how to manage drunks. When the box with the Drambuie arrived, she slowly drew it out. There was no card. She packed it up again and went to the local pharmacy and asked the pharmacist if he would make sure there was nothing odd in it. She didn't bother to tell Blair about it because he came home, as usual, late and drunk. A week later, she was startled when the pharmacist phoned her to say there was enough nicotine in the Drambuie to kill any man who was a smoker and not in perfect health. So a police investigation was started. The news buzzed round headquarters, and Fox was stricken with fear. He thought he must have run mad. He had heard what happened to policemen in prison. It would possibly be shown on the television programme Crime Scotland, and the bottle would be held up. That shopkeeper might recognise it. Something on his day off impelled him towards Loch Doo. It was a misty day, with the sun just beginning to break through, turning the loch to a sheet of gold. There was the smell of frying bacon coming from the police station as Fox knocked nervously at the door. The door opened, and the tall figure of Hamish Macbeth looked down at him. "Come in," ordered Hamish. "Sit down, drink coffee, and tell me why on earth you tried to murder Mr. Blair." "You can't possibly know," wailed Fox. "Who saw me?" "No one. Look, Blair tried to kill you, so you try to kill Blair. He got away with it, and you won't. Right?"
"Right," said Fox.
"My fingerprints are on that bottle. All our fingerprints at headquarters are on file." And having said that, he burst into tears. "Sit down." "That's better." Hamish tore off a sheet of kitchen paper. "Dry your eyes. Put a good lot of sugar in that coffee. First, you'll need to leave the police force. You're not cut out for it. Now, tell me where you bought the stuff." Fox described his trip to Wick, and to the Asian shopkeeper. When he had finished, Hamish said, "We must get the evidence. If I didn't hear good understanding of how Blair can drive a man to murder, I wouldn't be helping you." "I assume Thorn Bottle is in forensics," Fox nodded. "You may be in luck. There is a shinty match tonight over in Golspie. I heard someone saying the forensic boys were all going. So we get over there, break in, take an innocent bottle, substitute it, and that should do the trick." A little colour returned to Fox's pale cheeks. "Can you do it?" "Can we do it, you mean?" said Hamish. "Now, I don't suppose you've eaten anything, so I'll make you a bacon bap. I'm going fishing on the loch, so you can come with me. Tell me again where you bought the stuff." Fox enjoyed that day on the loch, almost wistfully, the way people look back on and wish for the innocence of childhood. Soon it was evening, and, unfortunately, it was light all night long. Fox could not guess how on earth Hamish expected to break in. He knew the place was heavily burglar-alarmed. Hamish borrowed an old car from the local garage, and, at 8 o'clock, they set off for Strathbane. To Fox's surprise, instead of driving to the lab, Hamish parked outside a trim bungalow. "Honk the horn if anyone gets suspicious," he said, and before Fox could ask him what he was going to do, Hamish had left the car and gone up to the house. After half an hour, Hamish came back grumbling. "The next film I see where the hero picks the lock in a few seconds, I'll throw something at the screen," he complained. "Who lives there?" "Bruce, head of the lab. Always forgetting the keys, so I guessed he'd have a spare set in the house." Hamish parked some way away from the lab. "You can follow me and shout if you see anyone coming." Knowing that the side entrance of the lab was heavily screened with bushes, Hamish chose to enter that way, but waiting until the CCTV camera had swung in the other direction. He found the bottle and replaced it with a similar one after wiping it carefully to get rid of any fingerprints. He put the bottle with the nicotine in it into a plastic bag. He then had a few nervous moments trying to judge the swinging of the CCTV camera, but heaved a sigh of relief when he finally rejoined Fox. Back in the car, Hamish cut short Fox's thanks and said, "Do you want this as a souvenir?" He took the bottle out of its bag and handed it to him. Fox grinned and chucked it out the window. "So you can put your resignation in tomorrow," Hamish added. Fox burst out laughing. "I don't need to. Thanks to you, I'll get that fat bastard yet." Hamish said in a very quiet voice, "Get out of the car." Something made Fox suddenly frightened. He scrambled out, and Hamish drove off. But Hamish drove round several corners and waited. He finally drove back and got out of the car and carefully retrieved the bottle, which would now have a good set of Fox's prints on it. He managed to return it to the lab and collect the false one. Then he had to take Bruce's keys back. Once clear of Strathbane, he stopped on the moors. Fox seemed to think he had been very clever to find a shopkeeper who did not have CCTV. But what Indian or Pakistani these wicked days would be without some sort of camera? He decided to go to Wick the following morning. Hamish was coldly angry, and cursed himself for being such a fool in trying to help Fox. A quote came into his head as he drove north the next day. "Thou shalt not kill, but needst not strive officiously to keep alive." It was tempting to do nothing and watch that precious pair trying to kill each other. On the other hand, he could not condone murder. He found the shop and interrogated the owner. "Yes," he said, "I do have the camera. Very clever. It's in that clock on the wall." "Do you still have the film from a week ago? That would be Saturday afternoon," said Hamish. "Yes, indeed. I just changed the tape, but have the old one. Officer, is it about a crime? I have a great longing to be on television. I dream often of such a thing." "Let me watch the tape and we'll think of something." It was a very sophisticated recording, and there, as clear as day, was Fox buying the drambuie. "You see," said the shopkeeper eagerly, "it is the drambuie, and see, he buys nicotine refills. The drambuie is not often asked for." "This is what you must do if you want to appear on television," said Hamish. "I have the phone number of Crime Scotland here, and I want you to call them. You are to say you kept the tape because the young man looked suspicious, right?" "Thank you. I'll do it now." Fox sat in front of his television set that evening, feeling pleased with himself. He had outclassed Hamish Macbeth. He switched to Crime Scotland. The programme was almost halfway through. He sat forward in alarm. Surely he had seen those brown features before. "Yes, indeed," the man was saying. "He was a young white man, but shifty, very shifty. He was looking all over to see if I had a camera, and I was frightened and thought he had come to rob me." Fox gave a yelp and ran to the window. Two police cars had driven up in front of the flats where he lived. He grabbed his car keys and wallet and fled down the back stairs of the flats and out through the laundry room and straight into the waiting arms of Detective Chief Inspector Blair and two policemen.
"Thought you might come this way," said Blair with a fat smile.
He took out a truncheon and struck Fox in the balls. Fox screamed and fell to the ground. Blair tried to kick him in the head.
"That's enough," said one of the policemen, pulling him off.
Fox suddenly leapt to his feet and scrambled up the stairs, lost his footing, somersaulted backwards onto the concrete laundry room floor, struck his head, and lay still. The policeman who'd restrained Blair knelt down beside Fox and felt for a pulse. He looked up.
"He's dead, sir."
"He fell and banged his head. Get it?" yelled Blair. "I didn't touch him. And if either of you says anything different, I'll make your life hell on earth."
Jimmy Anderson called on Hamish the following afternoon, to find him lounging in his front garden with Charlie, and the dog sprawled at his feet.
"I've often thought you mad, Hamish, to shut yourself away up here, but, man, it can be a filthy, dirty life in Strathbane. Give me a dram and I'll tell you about it. I feel like Elvis, all shook up."
Hamish became worried. Jimmy looked frightened, and he had hardly ever seen the detective look scared of anything before. Charlie lumbered after them.
"We'd better go into the living room," said Hamish. "I'll get the bottle and glasses. The chairs are stronger there."
Edging his way carefully through the kitchen, Charlie made it to the sofa in the living room and sat down with a sigh of relief. Hamish came in with the whiskey bottle and glasses and set them down on the coffee table.
"Are you sure about this?" he asked. "You've been off the stuff for a while. You'll need a dram yourself when you hear what I've got to say."
Hamish poured him a measure, and Jimmy gulped it down and held out his glass for more.
"Just the one," admonished Hamish, "and then it's black coffee for you. There you are. Now, what's so awful?"
"Blair's run mad and killed Henry Fox."
"What? How?"
"Well, the bottle of drambuie that was sent to Blair had Fox's fingerprints on it. An Asian shopkeeper confirmed that someone answering Fox's description bought it. Blair was sent to arrest him. He caught him just as he was trying to flee out the back door of the flats. Blair says he tripped and fell, but at the autopsy, he had bruising in the groin area and a big bruise on his head. The policeman who witnessed it just kept saying in wooden sorts of voices that Fox fell down the stairs, and said stairs caused all the injuries. Blair has been suspended, but he'll get away with it."
"Blair's gone over the edge now," said Hamish. "I'll hear dram myself. I'm next, unless..."
"You're not going to kill him first," exclaimed Charlie.
"No, but I need to think of a way of putting the brakes on the man," said Hamish.
After Jimmy had left, Hamish asked Charlie to look after the dogs and hired a rust bucket of a car from the garage. It had a tape deck and a window on the passenger side which was stuck halfway down, but it got him there and was anonymous enough. He parked at the end of Blair's street and waited. Hamish wondered if he had gone to the pub. It was the wife, Mary, he needed to talk to. After 10 minutes, he phoned Blair's number. To his relief, Mary answered the phone.
"It's me, Hamish," he said. "I need to see you alone."
"Oh, Sarah," cooed Mary. "Maybe I can get out for a wee bit. I feel like stretching my legs. I'll see you in the Bobbity."
Hamish got out of the car and walked to the cafe called Bobbity, two streets away. It was run by a busty Latvian woman with a welcoming smile. The coffee bars might be sucking the customers away from the tea shops, but Bobbity was a success because of a generous supply of tea in every pot served. People in Strathbane were as addicted to strong tea as Jimmy Anderson was to whisky. Mary came bustling in. No one looking at her could ever guess she had once walked the streets. She wore her usual tweed suit and brogues. The cafe was nearly empty, the high tea rush being over. Hamish had ordered tea and cakes. He had hoped that Mary would laugh at the mere suggestion that her husband had murdered Fox, but her first words sent his heart down into his regulation boots.
"So you think he did it," she said, "and you're worried he'll come after you."
"First things first, he's going to get away with murder."
"Yes. There were two policemen there at the time, and they both swear Fox fell down the stairs."
"And what were the forensics like? Any blood on the stairs?"
"No," said Mary. "Look, Fox was hated because of the way he crept to Daviot, and was always trying to steal credit that belonged to someone else. The sad thing is, nobody cares."
"Family? Girlfriend?"
She shook her head.
"Just one unloved orphan, that was Fox. But I tell you one thing, I bought a state-of-the-art recorder. My man can't resist bragging. I'll bet you sooner or later, when he's drunk, he'll gabble."
"And we'll have him," said Hamish.
"No, you won't. This marriage suits me. But I'll tell him that if you or I or anyone near him turns up deed, I'll turn him in."
In vain did Hamish argue with her. He left feeling worried. He decided to have a word with Harriet Munro before she left Strathbane. She had been moved to the women's prison. He hoped she wasn't thinking of committing suicide. He was taken aback to find Harriet looking well rested and cheerful.
"Prison seems to suit you," he said.
"Everyone here is so kind," said Harriet. "I have a nice job in the library."
Hamish studied her glowing face and said,
"So you're in love at last. Lesbian, are you?"
"Yes, and it took going to prison to discover it."
"Have you no remorse?"
"For the Sinclairs? Not a bit. There's one thing I didn't tell you. The only reason Selwyn slept with me was because he bet the other men in the office that he could. They were crowded into his office one morning, laughing and cheering. Droopy Drawers Martha was off sick. I pressed the intercom, and there was darling Selwyn describing every moment of our time together. I thought of suicide. Then I thought people like him didn't deserve to live, or his wife for that matter. I hope there isn't a hell, for I never want to see them again."
Hamish left, feeling depressed. Peter Haggis would no doubt quote the bit in the Bible about the wicked flourishing like the green bay tree. He had a sudden longing to see Elspeth. He realized suddenly that he had relied on her almost psychic ability in the past. He drove back to Loch Dhu, stopping off at the castle to collect his dogs.
"Your friend Elspeth Grant is upstairs," said Charlie. "She's doing a documentary on immigrants working in the Highlands. The ones here are paid over the living wage, so George is absolutely thrilled at the idea of being on the telly. I had to stop him dyeing his hair, or what's left of it."
Hamish sprinted up the stairs from Charlie's flat, shouting back down to his dogs to stay where they were. Elspeth was in the reception area, interviewing Colonel Halberton Smythe. Suddenly she looked across at Hamish and gave a little nod.
"Poor George," thought Hamish. "He's acted so long like a colonel out of central casting that the act has become part of him."
At last the director called,
"It's a wrap."
Hamish took a seat in reception while the proceedings were wound up and arrangements made for the following day. Elspeth came over to join him.
"That bad?" she asked. "Tell me about it. Come up to my room."
Elspeth had been given one of the new suites on the first floor, created by knocking two of the old ones together.
"Whiskey or coffee?" she asked.
"Coffee's fine. Phone room service. I'm going to change."
Just after the coffee was delivered, Elspeth emerged, wearing jeans and a baggy checked blouse.
"That's better," she said, accepting a cup of coffee. "Now, tell me what's scaring you."
Hamish was always amazed at Elspeth's psychic intuition. He told her the whole tale of Blair killing Fox. They talked long into the night, and then, somehow, found themselves wrapped round each other in bed, without quite knowing how it had happened. Hamish found himself being shaken awake as the early sun rose over the mountains.
"Get up now," shouted Elspeth. "It might be too late."
"What? How?" Hamish rubbed the sleep from his eyes.
"Hamish, what would any blackmailed murderer do?"
He stared at her. Then he said,
"Murder her, of course."
Driving as fast as the old rust bucket would go, Hamish headed for Strathbane. Again he parked at the end of Blair Street and called Mary. He was relieved when she answered.
"Oh, Alice," she said, "I'll see you in Bobbity's."
When she arrived, she asked,
"Have you ordered anything?"
"I was waiting for you."
"Then let's go out to the car. You've got to hear this."
"Mary, if you've blackmailed him, he'll murder you."
"No, he won't. Come on."
In the car, Mary switched on a powerful tape recorder.
"I'm telling you, Mary," came Blair's voice. "I only thumped him in the gullies. He belted it for the stairs afore we could catch him, missed his footing and tumbled over backwards and crashed down, hitting his stupid head on the concrete floor. So they're all looking at me as if I was a murderer. The pathologist tells them all he's got bad bruising in the family jewels, and they all look at me and tell me I'm suspended from duty, pending further inquiries. Oh, Christ, that's the phone. You answer it."
Mary's voice.
"Yes, he's here, Mr. Daviot. You'd better take this. It's the boss."
Blair's voice again, very low and meek.
"I hope it's not bad news, sir, because..."
"What?"
"Oh, that is a relief, sir. I am most grateful to you, sir. All my best to Mrs. Daviot."
The sound of receiver being replaced, and then Blair chortling.
"Back to work in the morning, lassie."
Mary switched off the recorder.
"So you see, Hamish, nothing to worry about."
"But what about that car accident? Fox said Blair tried to kill him."
"I don't think my husband would actually kill anyone, Hamish. And if he'd tried to kill Fox that time, he'd have told me."
"If by any chance he does tell you, Mary, and you record it, give it to the police. Don't hang about, promise?"
"Okay. But he's really not all that bad, Hamish. You don't know him like I do."
Hamish tried to race back to Loch Doo, but the old car broke down, and it took 2 hours for Ian from the garage to arrive with a breakdown truck. 2 hours in which Hamish had wandered around, trying without success to get a phone signal so that he could let Elspeth know what had happened. When he got to the hotel, it was to find she had left. There wasn't even a note for him. Charlie, he was told, was out fishing and had taken the dogs with him. He tried several times to phone Elspeth, without success. Surely Elspeth was the last person to dismiss it lightly as a one-night stand, but he felt lonely and bereft. To match his mood, the good weather had broken. He walked out to the waterfront and leaned on the wall. Black fingers of cloud were streaming in from the west. He turned and walked up to the cliffs where the loch joined the sea. Mountainous waves were beginning to rear up, and the little puffins were scampering to their burrows. Herring gulls dived and screamed along with gannets and guillemots. Hamish found all the turmoil calming. He sat down on the heather at the edge of the cliff until he saw that the tide was coming in and the rain was beginning to fall. Soon those giant waves would come right over the top of the cliff. He returned to the police station to find Charlie in the living room. The fire was lit, and Charlie had a tray with a flask of coffee and a selection of pastries.
"Present from George," said Charlie. "Thanks, Charlie."
Hamish petted Lugs and Sally, then said,
"Elspeth didn't leave any message for me."
"Not with me." Hamish heaved a sigh.
I'll tell you what I found out about Blair."
Charlie listened carefully, and then said, "But he's still a murderer. What's your back?" The phone rang in the office.
"I'll get it," said Hamish. "For once I would welcome some work."
He felt a burst of gladness when he heard Elspeth's voice on the phone saying, "What happened?" When Hamish had finished telling her, she said, "Just look out, Hamish. What are you doing this weekend?"
"Nothing, I hope."
"Good. I've got the weekend off. Can you pick me up at Inverness Airport on Friday evening? I'll be on the flight that gets in at 6:30.
"I'll be there. Nothing can stop me."
When Hamish went back to the living room, Charlie said, "That would have been Elspeth. I can tell from the look on your face."
"Yes. Can you look after Lugs and Sonsy for the weekend?"
"You mean Lugs and Sally?"
"Oh, yes, them."
"Of course I will." When Hamish drove to the airport on Friday evening, he felt relaxed and happy. To hell with Harriet Munro and every evil monster on the planet. He had fought the demons before, and won. That was Death of a Ghost by M.C. Beaton, read by David Monteith.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.